Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Hello, and welcome to the final program in the life and times of Murray Robertson on Listen to Older Voices. Born in 1940, Murray had a strong classical piano upbringing, but he successfully transitioned in the late 1950s to be playing piano with the amazing Australian group, the Thunderbirds. While enjoying many years of success with the band, playing both live and in the studio, by the time the 1970s had arrived, Murray had, except for a reunion with the Thunderbirds, focused on his other work. Murray was initially an aircraft electrical engineer, but later became a designer draftsman with the Commonwealth Industrial Gases. In this final program, we learn how the job with the CIG led to work with early computers and, in particular, an industry software package in Ohio. However, on his return, Murray discovered the difficulty of getting a job as time had caught up and a new generation of young people were flooding into his industry. He then joined a working band that was supporting a tour by Australian legends such as Normie Rowe, Johnny Young, Marcy Jones and Buddy England. This leads Murray and I into some interesting discussions on musicians, music and ageing. We also learn of his late-in-life love affair with horses. Now, heading rapidly into his 80th year, he's happily sharing his life with Marcy Jones and together they continue to perform as a duo. We pick up now with Murray and I talking about the introduction of computers into his working life. So I will bring you back to my other question now about the introduction of the computers into the workplace. Was that something you adapted to or was that difficult?
No, it wasn't difficult. I thought I adapted to it very well. I could see how it was going, and I knew that it was going to be have a major influence on the sort of work that I was doing. There was a problem that initially a company called IBM had a major computer installation at the Commonwealth Industrial Gases, which was based on a big mainframe computer, and I never believed that that was the way it was going to go. It was cumbersome, and I never believed that it would have taken over the development of design. What did come about was a program called Pro Engineer, which was eventually purchased by Commonwealth Industrial Gases. I think they bought two or three terminals, which were standalone computers.
Mm-hmm.
And this program, Pro Engineer, was a 3D modelling system.
Okay.
So at the time when that came about, I was working on electric welding equipment, MIG, TIG, and ARC stick welding equipment. And the company wanted to develop a light-duty MIG welder. And in the end, we designed and built and marketed 24 versions of the same thing to do various things with different input voltages and have different uses. And this program enabled us to do that, where we could just design and build in from 3D models and produce 2D drawings of them and use 3D models to drive robotic-type metal punching machines and that sort of stuff. And this program enabled us to do that. With the one set of components, you could pull them together to make one model and then go to another model and pull another set together to make another model, and it was very efficient. The thing about that happened at that time in the last part of the 1990s was that the company was purchased by a merchant bank in New York, I think. I was told at one stage that the design centre for this company was no longer in Melbourne, but it was going to be in a place called Troy in Ohio in the United States. And if I wanted to maintain my job, I would have to take my family and move to Troy in Ohio. Now, Marcy and I did live in Sunbury for some time, and Troy in Ohio was like Sunbury is to Melbourne, as Troy is to Dayton in another major city in Ohio. It was about 20 mile north. And so it had some similarities, but it was a developing area. And part of this conglomerate that CIG ended up with was also a company in Troy, Ohio. There was a long-standing welding company, and that's where I went.
You did go?
Well, it was quite funny because I came home and told Marcy, I says, oh, you want to move to Ohio to live?
I can imagine the initial response.
And she's a very family-oriented person. She's got two sons in Melbourne and lots of friends, and that didn't go down very well.
No, I bet.
So I went back and told him. I said, no, I'm not going over there. But what was an advantage of mine was that I had the knowledge and the use of developing this series of welding machines on this Pro Engineer based platform, and they wanted to take it to America so they can build them over there. The only trouble was that it was developed using the metric system here in Melbourne,
of course,
and it had to be converted to Imperial.
Oh Lord.
So I had a fair amount of leverage going on here.
I bet you did.
And they said, well, how about 2 years? Going over to America for 2 years. And I came home with the 2-year proposal, and that was rejected. So we ended up with a 6 months agreement. So early in 1999, I think it was April, I took off to America on my own for 6 months.
Okay.
And I was supplied, I was put up in a hotel, an apartment block actually, and given a vehicle to drive, and I was there actually for 4 months.
Is that all it took you to do that conversion?
Yep, because they had the terminals, the Pro Engineer program installed there, and I just walked in. I took all the data from Melbourne on disk.
Right.
And just loaded it up and away we went.
So you probably didn't have a chance to see much of anything except the...
Not really. I did 2 trips. The first week was 10 days. In Milwaukee, they were using a metal processing plant,
mm-hmm.
another business, and I had to go over there and tell them what we were going to do and if they were comfortable doing it with that, and whether the association... The Hobart Brothers was the company in Ohio, the welding company.
Okay.
It was a long-standing business that they bought in. So that's where I was. And this Hobart Brothers had this connection with this metal processors in Milwaukee, so I had to go there. That was the first trip. And the second one was for 6 months, was it going to be.
Were you pleased to get back to Australia after that? Or were you enjoying yourself over there?
I enjoyed it. Because I was doing stuff that I was very... I mean, it was a bit of a pain having to convert all this stuff to from metric to imperial.
Yeah.
But, you know, it had to be done.
Yeah.
And I was very familiar with the process and the program I was dealing with. It's a very high-level computer program, which helped me in a later period to deal with the same sort of program, well, high-level music production on computers
I was going
as well.
Your job's folded in Australia. It's gone over to the States. You've gone over there to help them set it up. You come back to Australia. What do you do? Because you weren't really playing much in the way of music at that stage.
No. Well, after I got back in 2 weeks, I didn't have a job. But there was a company in Melbourne here who was promoting and selling the Pro Engineer program, and I did a bit of contract work with them, going into other businesses and setting it up on just, you know, selling it, showing people what it could do. And
so did that period actually flag the end of your full-time work then?
Yes, because the work was so precise and centered on an individual program, I didn't want to go back to working on paper and pens, I would have found that very difficult. And that with this sort of thing, you're always dealing with a higher level of education for young people coming out of technical colleges and universities who have this sort of expertise.
Yes.
And they're 25 years old, their full life ahead of them.
Yes. And you must have been either in or near your 60s by now.
Yes. Well, yeah, I was 59 when I was thinking I was going to work for the next 6 years, because 65 was then the appropriate time to consider what they call retirement, but didn't appeal to me too much at retirement.
You aren't the sort of person that would just sit back and put their palms up towards the sun and that's it.
No.
And yet, I mean, looking at you now, and we're 20 years past where we're talking about currently, you're very energetic, you're very alive, look very healthy. So, you know, you're not ready to roll over yet.
No.
What did you do? I mean, you're not the sort of person just to sit around. So how did you keep your brain and yourself active if you weren't working?
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices, promoting positive ageing. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Murray Robertson. And Murray is talking about the transition from full-time work into what was a form of retirement.
I was still involved with music. I joined a band that toured Australia with the legends, as they called them. And it was Normie Rowe, Johnny Young, Marcy Jones and Buddy England. And we did quite a lot of work with that group.
Right. And that was a national tour, was it?
Well, we went up into the interior of New South Wales and did quite a bit of the country up there, and Victoria as well. Did quite a lot of shows with that lineup around Victoria and New South Wales.
One thing about being a musician or being involved in the music industry, it's one of the probably few industries where it seems to me the older you get, the better you get. Would you agree with that?
Depends how open your mind is.
Well, would you see your skills as refining as you've got older, and in some ways that you might be a better player and a better...
Yes.
Yes.
I was never physically adept at playing extremely well, I never thought. But the knowledge of writing and harmony and how music worked and what you could do developed quite a lot. Just for my own interest in it, more than anything.
Well, I just wanted to know more about it. I think you're underselling yourself, but that's fine. Most people in the music business I know don't undersell themselves, but I think that's in itself is a positive criteria, because you've only got to look back at your career. You've played with some of the best, and you've played alongside some of the best.
Yeah, but a lot of my contemporaries and guys I knew were playing piano at the time when we were coming into, you know, out of the rock and roll era or during the rock and roll era. I used to play solo piano in piano bars, and something never appealed to me.
No, but that's
I never ever did it. I was never what they'd call a solo pianist. But I look back now, and I've looked at film of guys like Oscar Peterson playing it, and I'm thinking, how do you get to do that? I still think, how do you get to do that? And it's just amazes me how physically adept they are at dealing with this sort of stuff.
And even if you move outside the piano genre into whether it be guitar or whatever, I mean, especially in terms of the blues, you look at the artists that have come out of the United States, and many of them have done their best work when they're in their 60s and 70s. You know, people like, you know, Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, and they're revered almost. We don't quite have that in Australia, do we, with our musicians?
Well, I've got a theory about that. We were talking about where all this evolved from, and I believe it evolved from New Orleans and the people who grew up under all these influences that were going on there. This didn't exist in Australia, and it never has.
No.
Why, I don't know. I mean, there must have been a lot of Celtic influence because of the people who came to Australia from Scotland and Ireland, but there's never been a parallel development of music in Australia as there was that came out of New Orleans in the 20s, 1920s onwards, from New Orleans to Chicago to New York.
Mm.
I don't know why, but it's just a fact of life. So all our influences came via what we heard from America.
Indeed. You either dropped deliberately or it just floated out of you early in our talk that if we were to talk about music as it's being produced and played today, that you're less than impressed. Would that be accurate?
Well, I don't see a lot of education involved in music today. It's become a lot easier. Earlier in my career, to play music, you had to be able to play an instrument. You had to be able to sit down on your own or with a group of musicians and actually play your instrument. Now, and I can do it myself and have done, I can create that straight off a computer keyboard or via an instrument into a computer.
It's become more a world for technicians then, hasn't it?
Well, it can be. I mean, you still, musically, you've still got to know what you're doing.
But if you look at music production as you were involved back in the, certainly back in the 50s and 60s, you didn't have harmonizers and you didn't have, you know.
We didn't need them.
No, exactly. But these days, you put somebody in a studio, you can make them sound as good as you want.
Yeah, but is it real?
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I don't think it is at all. No, I don't think it is at all. And I think it lacks a soul because of that.
I mean, I've always collected music of live performance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got a lot of, both Marcy and I have got a large amount of studio recordings here. But my go-to when I want to listen and I want to revise how I feel about stuff, I go to live performance and I collect them specifically because, to my mind, that's when people excel.
That's when you show your chops.
Well,
because you're there.
The audience draws it out of you, and and people at the level that I'm looking at. I'm talking about Ray Charles. I've got a video of a studio recording session of Frank Sinatra. This is live stuff, you know. It's on. It's happening as you look, and I like listening and looking at that stuff.
We've looked at Murray, the musician, and we've looked at Murray, and this is a little harder to put into one word, the technical, drawing, innovating side of you. There must be a little bit more to you. You're not only those people, you're part of a human race. If you look around you, what's happening around you in the world today, is this the world as you might have imagined it 40 years ago?
I don't know if I ever thought of it like that. You become aware of what's going around you these days because of communication.
Are there things that concern you?
Oh, yeah. I don't know how you can sell water. That escapes me. How ownership and exchange of water for money can occur. I think that's the weirdest thing that I've ever heard.
And yet it's happening.
And that it's happening.
Yeah.
And somebody's profiting from it, I think. A lot of the stuff that we're dealing with today is driven by greed, which is not all that good.
If you had a group of young boys and girls in here now, you know, young teens, and they were interested in following a career or developing a career in music, would you have any advice for them?
Oh, I bet the main thing I would say to them, if you're going to undertake something, don't do it for self-gratification, do it for the benefit of somebody else, and you'll get more out of it.
Do you think Australians in general as a nation appreciate the arts?
I think they do at a higher level. I think opera and dance and higher levels of performance are appreciated. But the markets drive these things and the teenage market drives teenage music. And I've got a theory that I call the pyramid theory. If you put a pyramid on its base and point at the apex at the top, that's where the highest level of performance is. And the width of the pyramid at the top represents the audience. If you travel down to the base of the pyramid, that's where the lowest level of performance is, but that's where the widest audience is. Now, I don't know why that is, but that's what it is. I mean, you take opera and higher levels of classical performance, and the audiences are limited.
Yes.
But you go down to what is represented today as pop music, at the bottom of the base of the pyramid, that's where the biggest audience is.
It always has been. I think what you're making is a really good point, and if I could just draw it out a little further, if you look at funding in terms of what we might call the arts, and let's talk more about music because it's something you and I are both involved in, it's that top of the apex where most of the money goes. And further down you go to that broad base, there's less investment.
Well, the investment is made by the people who buy and listen to the music.
Is it? I mean, don't you think government has a role in terms of they give out a lot of money to the opera companies? And the...
Well, so they should, I believe.
You don't think they
because
should?
Because it costs a lot more to put on an opera than it does a rock concert, for instance. There's a lot more people involved. There's a lot more expertise. It's just a fact of life. I mean, the money that's created in pop music is generated by the people who buy tickets. They're very highly priced these days.
They're very highly priced, possibly out of the reach of a lot of people sometimes.
I mean, it's not uncommon to pay in excess of $200 to buy a single ticket to a pop concert by an established, you know, well-known artist. It generates their own level of income. And the production of these pop concerts shows how much money there is involved because the level of technical and physical requirements is made to set up one of these concerts is huge
enormous.
And very expensive.
Well, that brings me back to my point. There's very little money goes into that, and that's why the tickets are so expensive. And yet, you're right, the production of putting on a big show these days is very expensive.
There is one aspect of this is that the technology has caused this in a way, because if the technology's there, they'll use it.
Oh, yes.
It doesn't make it better.
No.
But that's just a fact of life. I mean, the technology, the computerisation of lighting systems and sound systems these days. But I also believe that the development of pop music is more visual than audible. I think the visual aspect of it has taken over, and that has a lot to do with the diminishing quality of the audible. Because you can only absorb so much. If you look at the development of this sort of stuff, when I started, the idea of producing a video in order to sell a pop song didn't exist.
No, that's right.
But now you can't do it without it.
In fact, I think I pick up on your point. I think the visual is almost more important to some people than the audio.
Well, there's probably an equal amount of money spent on the visual production of a song than there is the audible production.
We can go back to the 80s for that, can't we? Wasn't there a song, Video Killed the Radio Star? And that's really, that's begun to sum it up, I think.
And we haven't dealt with the horses either.
The horses?
Well, when I was 60 years old, I visited a woman who's become a very good friend of mine, somebody I was playing with at the moment who owns this establishment over on the other side of Melbourne, where she runs a pony club for children and provides riding expertise for adults and that. And I visited her establishment with a friend of mine, and she said, who we got here, another starter, meaning did you want to join the group? And I thought, why not? So that started a 12-year involvement with one main thoroughbred horse that I bought. Well, I didn't buy. He was given to me at 3.5 years old, and I spent the next 8 years of his life together with him developing dressage, learning myself and developing him. I'd always had an interest in horses all my life. Not that I'd ever done anything with them, but whenever I was faced or had to look at something to deal with horses, I always had an interest in it or something there that attracted me to it. And this was brought out in this, and Marcy and I ended up buying a property here in near Kyneton, where we live, that I kept two of the horses for 12 years. And it was only the physical aspect of it, and there's a number of reasons why I stopped. But
it's pretty hard on the body, isn't it?
It's hard on the body, and you have to have a horse that has an adaptability to dressage and the higher levels, but I took him through a number of grades, and the last 8 months of my association with my horse was trail riding around the Macedon Ranges, which he loved and I enjoyed very much.
Yeah, I can, as you're telling me, you can see it in your eyes, you know, they well, started to sparkle.
I know, he is now owned by a friend of mine up near Heathcote, and I visit him from time to time, and it's something I miss every day.
Oh, of course.
Because owning horses at that level and dealing with horses at that level is not something you can say, oh, I'll do today, but I won't do tomorrow. It's a every day of the week, 365-day-a-year job,
right.
And you're responsible for their well-being and feeding and stuff. So when it's not there, it's something I miss.
Murray, our time is just about up. It's been an interesting journey you've been on, isn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah. Unless you walk down the street and as you're crossing the road, the bus hits you. Oh, but it doesn't. You've got still got quite a few years left in your life yet. As we've said, you're pretty energetic, you're pretty healthy.
Yeah, I'm...
Bits might be falling off because that's of our age, it does that, you know.
Yeah, my skeleton's suffering a bit from, well, this is my 80th year. So my skeleton's starting to show the wear and tear of 79-odd years. So it's not that I don't wish to do anymore. It's just that it limits
on what you
your ability to do it. And pain is not something that you enjoy.
No, and sadly, as a lot of listeners would understand, it's part of that journey through the older life.
Even going out and playing now can be a bit of a challenge, but we manage.
Yeah.
I mean, carting equipment around and lifting and it's a bit of a challenge as well. So we enjoy playing and we're still doing a bit of it.
Well, I hope there's many more years of happiness and playing together.
Thank you very much,
Murray,
Rob. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.